Now I'm very delighted to welcome you to Slicing the Brain. I don't think it's put anybody off, in fact, which is great. We've got a lovely crowd here, which is absolutely wonderful. So I'm really delighted. I think we're really very honoured to welcome Professor Anja Hurlburt to Ledbury Poetry Festival. Thank you very much for coming. Anja Hurlburt is a professor of visual neuroscience at Newcastle University. She graduated from Princeton with a BA in physics, has an MA in physiology from Cambridge University, a PhD in brain and cognitive sciences from MIT, and an MD from Harvard Business School.
Medical.
In 2000... Very wonderful, wonderful, amazing spectrum. I don't really understand what any of those things are, but I think they made the sound wonderful. So,
yeah, yeah.
In 2004, she co-founded the Institute of Neuroscience at Newcastle with the late Professor Colin Ingram. And in 2012, they established the Centre for Translational Systems Neuroscience. Professor Anja Hurlburt is also a science trustee at the National Gallery, and I just thought, we want one of those. Can we have a science trustee? I think it would be really interesting to see what that would do to the events at the festival. It would be very interesting. She has a list of many publications, including Colour Vision, Understanding Hashtag The Dress, which was published in 2015, and I don't know, but if any of you saw, there was lots in the papers about that, because it seemed that there was a particular dress that people saw as in different colours. Yeah. The description of the book is a widely viewed image of a dress elicits striking variation in colour perceptions. That was fascinating, seeing those in the newspapers. And I'm also equally delighted to welcome Valerie Laws, who so wonderfully responded when I said to her, please, can we have an event that combines poetry and science? I'm that kind. And you're just wonderfully responsive to that request. So Valerie Laws is a poet, crime and comedy novelist, playwright, swimmer, mathematician and theoretical physicist, skull collector. Her poetry collections include All That Lives and The Rotting Spot, and she's held various residencies, including at London Pathology Museum and the Institute for Aging and Health at Newcastle University. Many prizes include a Wellcome Trust Arts Award and prizes in the National Poetry Competition, and remarkable collaborations, including the Quantum Sheep Project, painting haiku on sheep, I think, and also putting quantum haiku on inflatable beach balls. Wonderful champion for the exploration of science using poetry, really wonderful. And we shall see a film today that has travelled all through Europe and the UK. So that's great. So I think we're in for a real treat. So please, I will hand you over to Professor Anja Hurlburt and Valerie Laws. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Is this working? Yes. I thought I would start with this before we start with our science and poetry. As you probably know, if you've been to other events, English Pen is partnered with Ledbury Poetry Festival this year, thinking about sharing our time with poets who are being oppressed throughout the world. And my particular partner is Liu Xia from China. Her husband received the Nobel Peace Prize and was promptly imprisoned for his pains, and then she was put under house arrest, where she's been for some years, and is unable to access him or anyone else. When we think of poetry and the arts as somehow luxuries, we need to remember that the poets are the people who dictators come for, quite early on in their process, and these are important words, and I would love to think that she might know that her words are being heard right across the world. So I'm going to read a short poem of hers, which was translated by Ming Di and Jennifer Stern, Another Kind of Death by Liu Xia. Joseph, the mute child, stands in the shadow of a piano, dark as a big blackbird. Sunlight doesn't reach him, and neither does the candlelight from the hospital chapel. I can't touch him with my hands. He stands there year after year as the pages of the music book turn. As the pages of the music book turn, he stands there year after year, and I can't touch him with my hands. The candlelight from the hospital chapel doesn't reach him, nor does sunlight, in the shadow of a piano, dark as a big blackbird. Joseph, the mute child, stands. Thank you. Let's all think of her and those like her. Annie, would you like to say something?
Yes. Well, it's really thrilling to see so many of you here. We rather thought that not just the title, Slicing the Brain, but the notion of a lot of science might put people off at a poetry festival. I also gather there's a final going on in some sports competition somewhere. So we might lob a few bits of art and science back and forth at each other in lieu of that. So I think normally you wouldn't really think that science writing bears any resemblance to poetry. You think of scientific writing as very dry, factual. You think of poetry as evocative and emotional, lyrical, dramatic. But I actually think there's a huge number of similarities between scientific writing and poetry, because I think both really strive to convey meaning very efficiently and with precision and with depth. And I think in scientific writing you can, and in poetry you can hold in a very few short phrases descriptions that in ordinary prose would take paragraphs to complete, and these descriptions are basically of life itself. The choice of words is always very careful. But so more importantly, I think scientists and poets do share something in striving to create something new. And I think the worst thing you can say to a scientist is your work is derivative, and that's probably one of the worst things you can say to a poet or an artist as well. And in brain science, we try to enlighten and discover, and I think in Valerie's poems that's what she does as well, and she's enlightened so much of science for us scientists who've worked with her. She's had some wonderful collaborations and residencies both in King's College London, where she worked together with artist Susan Aldworth, and you'll see their installation product of their work together in a few minutes. And she's also worked with the Institute of Aging and Health at Newcastle University and with the Institute of Neuroscience there. And she's brought her own scientific observation skills and what's resulted from those and from her analytical skills is the most beautiful, rich, lyrical poetry you can imagine. So I'd love to hand over to Valerie and then let her give you some examples.
This particular one isn't so much scientific, but it's a good introduction to some of the themes we'll be talking about. And it's what started me on this whole quest to have all these scientific residencies and collaborations. So this is about my mother when she had dementia and I was helping to care for her. And she had a persistent delusion that my father was two men. And she always called him the men at that point. And around about the same time, my marriage had broken up. A long marriage had suddenly broken up, and I hadn't quite got back to dating yet. So this is about the combination of those two times in my life, which quite a lot of this collection, All That Lives, is about. My mother's twin lovers. I must get back to the men, my mother announces, then slyly meets my eye, as I choose this time to avoid my usual reply. I know what you're thinking, she's triumphant, that there's only one of them, but you're wrong, you know. My mother is having an affair. She's cheating on my father with another man who lives with them, looks like his twin, and even shares his name. I think they must be cousins, she explains defiantly. Before going to bed with my father, she slips next door, turns back the spare bed quilt and leaves her slippers there so the other man won't suspect. She has doubled her marriage, two-timed adultery. After blameless years of barely moderation, let alone excess in anything, she now has a surplus of husbands. It's as if in creating my father's double, she's conjured up her own wicked twin, denied a life till now when time is running short. She has gained an extra husband, while the one I had is gone, which is fine. But now, my elderly mother with dementia has a more exciting sex life than I do, kicking up her heels while mine have been dragging. Perhaps it's time, I think, as I take her home to her lovers, for me to get back to the men. Thank you.
I love the fact that your personal experiences appear in your poetry, much of which is autobiographical.
Yes. Yes, my mother actually died of Alzheimer's disease, and I was there when she died over her final three-day coma and during the process of her actual death. And within a year of that, my father died suddenly of an aneurysm, and I was there for that as well. So it was really witnessing those deaths that led me to think, what's happening in someone's brain when they die? I really wanted to understand more about it. And that's why I began this whole process of working with scientists. And I have to say, it's been an incredible journey to work with scientists like Anya, who are so willing to share their time and their expertise with artists and poets. So it's been a fantastic collaboration. And I hope that I can help other people to engage with the science. I'm just one of those people who likes to know about things that might be scary. And some people might be the same and some people might not.
It's another point I'd just like to interject where I feel that you have a resemblance to a scientist, because scientists also want to know. Yeah. And the notion that in somehow delving into how the brain works will take away the mystery of the self is very wrong. I feel that the more you know, the bigger the mystery becomes. As a great science writer, Matt Ridley, wrote, as you clear the as you clear away the forest of ignorance, the perimeter just grows. So there's even more to discover. And you didn't shy away from delving into learning about the cellular processes underlying dementia, even though you might have shied away from that because of the rawness of the experience with your mother's death.
Yes. Well, speaking of autobiographical, Matt Ridley has some connection with Anya here. That's a very profound quotation, because it's a bit like what happens in physics, that the more we learn about cosmology, the further away the edges of the cosmos recede, the more that we understand. So, Anya mentioned before a collaboration, when I was collaborating with Susan Allworth. We didn't bring any sheep here today, or even any beach balls, bit of a health and safety nightmare. So I'm hoping that this will play all right. So one of the things that I did was I learned about apoptosis, and I think it's interesting to play it now after that poem, because that first poem combines themes of life and death. And people said to me, isn't it morbid to spend time learning about death? But the more you learn about death, the more you realize how intimately connected it is with life. And one of the processes that enables us to exist at all is apoptosis, programmed cell death. And all our cells basically are told every day whether to kill themselves or to go on and divide. And it's that kind of process that enables the fetus in the womb to develop fingers and all kinds of processes. So life and death are very intimately connected. I like to create installations which move and change. So I've designed this poem to undergo apoptosis and turn into the opposite message. So let's see if we can get this.
Cell suicide, a pleasure postponed. Your life is built on a death wish. From our conception, every cell has a default hope, a longing to self-destruct, collapse like a winter deck chair. Burst its skin and stir itself to slush like a Spain sliced jellyfish. Relax into salty consomme. Let those coded instructions it carries float away, dissolve undone. But the guilt trip call, the signal to stay alive, never stops coming. Says, don't give in to your Jones for Mr. Bones. Hold on, don't jump, come down from that ledge. Keep living, do it for the team. Keep giving, work, feed, breathe, give birth. Tear yourself in two, divide to multiply. Labour all your myriad cells. We need each brick in the body's living walls. One day at a time, you can do it. Don't give in. Not yet. Wait. Not yet. Wait. Not yet. Wait. Your life is built on death. Our concept, cell death. To self-destruct, collapse like a winter deck chair. Burst its skin and stir itself to slush like a spade-sliced jellyfish. Relax into salty consomme. Let those coded instructions it carries float away, dissolve undone. For the guilt trip call, the signal to stay alive stops coming. A sign, give in to your Jones for Mr. Bones. Jump down from that ledge, do it for the team. Tear yourself in two. Die. We need a breach in the body's living walls. Do it. Give in. Now. Now. Now.
Just to say, the artwork on there is by Susan Aldworth, who does medical science-based art. That piece was created for the Wellcome Trust Arts Award that we won for our joint project. So,
cell death is also very, very important in brain development, and I think that reminds me of what I think is one of the big themes of your work, which is identity, the self, consciousness, and how this seemingly metaphysical, spiritual thing is closely tied to the physical. And I feel also a lot of your work is about how one's identity changes through age, which is what you clearly saw with your mother, as she became a different person as her memories dissolved away. But even in typical development without any pathology, this happens, of course, all the time. And in adolescence, the brain changes far more rapidly than in any other time of life, and actually adolescence is a time when the connections in the brain are very, very rapidly rewiring themselves. And something like 50% of the connections that are there will get pruned away. And this great wave of thinning happens. The sheet of cortex that covers the surface of the brain literally thins from back to front in this great wave. And at the same time, new connections sprout up from below and between areas. And then those connections wither away as only the good and meaningful ones remain. And a lot of this work on the change of the brain in adolescence has been done by Sarah Jane Blakemore in London. It's wonderful work, but reading about it makes you feel slightly more sympathetic to your teenage children. Because it's just a time of vast identity change because of those physical changes in that organ which gives us ourselves.
Yes, yes. Yes, there is a reason why they're so horrible. So there you are. It's not your fault. It's biology. Neuroscience. Just to say, my other collection with pathology work in is the Facebook of the Dead. And the storyboards, the text forms of that poem are in there. But the films are on YouTube or through my website if you want to see them again. So... So now you've seen some nice art on a film, and we'll go into the brain itself. And the next two poems were quite a challenge for me as a poet, because I wanted to... Well, to start with, I wanted to understand myself in the first place, how the brain works, how the actual cells, the neurons of the brain actually work. And this is how they fire, and it's... I hope that I've given some idea from this, because it's quite a complex process, and I've tried to make this into poetry, which I think was quite a challenge. So Annie will be able to tell you how far I've succeeded or failed. So I'll do this next one, which is Pumping Ions. And I've imagined my father's particular brain, because obviously his was about to be starved of oxygen by the aneurysm bursting, which... basically the same effect as a stroke, starving the brain of oxygen. But this is how a brain would be working before anything like that happened. Inside my father's brain, like a stinging cell in a jellyfish, each neuron is winding itself like a watch, tightening its spring, squeezing its skin, pumping sodium out, potassium in, defying the current in the fluid it swims in, which would leach potassium out, leak sodium in. High on sugar, prepared to lash out, crack its spark of a whip, when a message arrives like a scent in the wind, to fire, pass it on, in a flash of relief, a flood of release, sodium in, potassium out. On a chemical wave, Nat King Cole, apple tart, trigger one, then another, in a firecracker chain, but always renewed, like magic candles which keep on igniting, while the neurons rewinding, plumping and tightening, sodium out, potassium in. I don't know whether you...
I think instead of lecture number 12 to cell physiology, level one, we'll just read that poem. It's very accurate. And I astonishment and your fascination at the mechanical nature of very life itself, because the action potential, the way a neuron communicates with another neuron, is absolutely fundamental to thought, senses, and movement. And each cell is working so hard in its dutiful, responsible way, and fundamentally physical way, again. And each cell doing this makes up this whole physiological system which powers life. And I love the idea of each neuron winding itself up and getting ready to pass on the message. It's a very apt metaphor. I think it's absolutely right. It's what neurons use most of their energy doing, is maintaining this so-called ion gradient across the membrane, pumping sodium out and pumping potassium in, and it just keeps doing that in order to get the cell ready to fire the action potential. And then once the action potential's bitten down an axon, it leaves behind what I think is a very lyrical name again, which is the refractory period, where the neuron will refuse to do anything more until it has recovered.
And it all runs on sugar, so sugar isn't all bad.
Yep.
And it's I think it's important to remember that, you know, like babies need quite a lot of fat and sugar for their brains, and I think older people do as well. Mm. I always think it may be why a lot of older people really like ice cream. It's their nature is protecting them. Nature tells us these things. Should I do the next one in that pair, the stroking?
I think stroking the brain is great.
So this will, bearing in mind what we've just covered, so this is basically what happens when there is a stroke. And I have to tell you that in learning this, without having the relevant sort of A levels or whatever, I spent time with scientists, and what I was having to learn, one professor told me, was kind of third year medical school level, and I can honestly tell you that my brain really, really hurt some of the time trying to learn this. So this is what happens when there is a stroke. Stroking the brain. A stroke in the brain starts with an absence, like a lightning strike, a withdrawal of work. Something is blocked, an artery bulging, or the blood is escaping somewhere unseen, starving some brain cells whose sugar rush stops. Each neuron is flagging, depolarizing. Its busy pumping is faltering now. Sodium is building instead of leaving. The cell becomes sick with it, saltier far than the sea that surrounds it. So water floods in a dangerous swell, a change in the tide, until it bursts open, digests itself dying, triggering others to fall in their turn, in radiating rings like dominoes falling, like silver birches when the meteorite hit Russia, in forests so dense it took decades to find. So like oars stroking, the ripples are spreading, a tiny tsunami leaving pale, soggy cell skins. The arteries shut down till the onslaught is over, then pour in hot blood, saving some, failing more. How to smile, lift a fork or a foot. How to breathe, gone for now or forever, high and dry on the shore. So I hope that helps to explain the process.
I don't think it can be said any better. That was wonderful.
So, if you would like to... I did some work in the Institute of Neuroscience, which Anya is the director of, with a neuroscientist called Fiona LeBeau, who's studying brain waves. And she uses slices of rat brain for this. So, should I do the poem first, and then you can explain it? So, as Anya said, the problem of consciousness is so interesting. Exactly what constitutes consciousness? And there are different kinds of brain waves named after Greek letters. And each time a brain wave has been discovered, nobody has known that there were others still to be discovered. So there may be more of them. And what they're doing, we don't know. But I was also interested to find that if you use you have to use small pieces of rat brain, which stay alive in suspension for a few days, and you can't use the whole brain. I don't know if this is still the case, but legally, just in case the rat has some awareness that it is just a brain in a jar. So we don't really know how much consciousness you would have. So this is about brain waves. Rat brain, waving, not drowning. Delta, theta, alpha, beta, gamma. This sliver of rat brain, suspended in a beaker of bubbling broth, still emits waves, its neurons firing, recharging, firing, for hours, even days. It's hard to believe I'm not watching it thinking. The oscillations printing out like ranges of crazy hills, could be peaks of squeaks, twitches of chopped off tail or whisker, thoughts of sex or scraps, circling like rats in a cage with no way out. Even governments have their doubts. Even a lab rat might still think, might know it's still thinking with a whole brain. too horrible to allow even to scientists to breed, euthanize, dissect. Hence this mere shaving of hippocampus, firing away at nothing. How aware of itself would your brain be, alive in a sensory deprivation tank? Thinking about consciousness with our conscious mind is hard. Harder to imagine its absence, using the same unvarying, inescapable equipment, chasing our mental tails round the cages of our skulls. Delta, theta, alpha, beta, gamma, each tide of waves newly detected washes us closer to what we don't yet know, what other electrical storms crackle, waving bravely unseen, maybe waving now in this submerged slice of rat, signalling, mayday, mayday, in rodent morse.
I'm sure there's lots of philosophers here who know far better than I do the history of the philosophical conundrum of the brain in a vat. It's a sort of philosophical concept which has been around since probably Descartes. This question of how we can prove that we're not actually just brains in vats, which are somehow hooked up to sensors which sense the outside world and feed it into us. So it ties into the question of whether reality is simply an illusion which we have created in our mental processes. The other question about a brain in a vat, which is posed by Moore, I see some heads shaking back there, so I hope I'm not mangling the problem of the brain in the vat. The other question which philosophers of mind like Derek Parfit have made out of the brain in the vat is how much of your body, you know, could you chop away, as it were, and still be yourself? I mean, if you end up with just your brain in a vat, are you really yourself? Or do you need your eyes, your sense of smell, your hearing, your sense of touch in order to be yourself? We can't really divide ourselves from the external environment which impinges on us and which the brain processes. But I think you've encapsulated all of those philosophical concepts very beautifully there. But the other thing about brains and vats is that, which Descartes and all those long-dead philosophers couldn't have imagined, is how much we've learned from slices of brains in petri dishes. And the mechanisms of memory have been entirely discerned through studying slices of rat brains or rabbit brains in petri dishes, which have been kept electrically and cellularly alive for days, weeks, months. And the connections between the brain cells within them have been kept alive for that period of time, demonstrating how lifelong memories might exist in cellular mechanisms. It's very, very exciting work, partly done by Timothy Bliss of the MRC in London, for example. But it does get dangerously close to the notion that bits of brain can express entire selves, even when they are disconnected from the body, which is an answer to Derek Parfit.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's what people are paying for when they leave their heads to be frozen and pay a lot of money for the privilege in the hope that they can be somehow resurrected onto a younger body. Nobody ever explains who's going to give up their younger body for these people's heads to be transplanted onto. That's somehow never mentioned. One would hope they have some choice in the matter. So, well, speaking of slices of brain, the next one I'm going to read is about dementia. This one is the scientist I was working with, one of them, Professor Robert Perry, is a neuropathologist, and he gave me a sort of personal tour around some slices of brain. And he taught me how to see the signs of dementia in the human brain, because Newcastle University has a brain bank. You can leave them your brain. and then they taxi it to the brain bank when you die. So you might want to consider that. I don't know how far this has gone in the last couple of years, but at one time you could only really see dementia in the brain at autopsy or afterwards. You couldn't see it in a living person. So when they start to see clinical signs of dementia in someone, the physical process is already well underway and the brain has been brilliantly compensating. And it's only when it can't compensate for the damage anymore that the actual signs start to show, which is one of the things that makes it hard to treat. So this was 3 years after my mother died, so I was able to actually see what had been happening in her brain. Slices of brain. Third anniversary of my mother's death from dementia, and I'm looking at slices of brain, stained pretty pink, the neurons purplish, their nuclei clear as strawberry pips. Like a magician in his many-coloured coat of patches, motley bow tie, hair like wild dendrites in a frenzy of thinking, the pathologist initiates me into what death has revealed. The donor's name is on the slides, their memorial, evidence of how memory escaped them. Alzheimer and his mates, Lewy body, Parkinson, vascular, alone or in cahoots, they miss no tricks. Tau proteins strangle and swamp, cutting off the synapses, keeping the thoughts corralled in tangles, scribbles of barbed wire around the nucleus, sometimes killing the cell like a rubber band round a lamb's balls. So a ghost tangle is left, guarding empty space. Are there ghost memories inside? Amyloid proteins lag the axons, the dendrites, the outreaching fronds which pass torches of thought until there's a plaque, like a fingertip print stubbed on the connections. Scattered booby traps, you have to look out for them. Cortical, hippocampal layers like lagoons and sandy beaches, slide after slide, pebbled with tangles, racked with plaques, in a shrinking brain losing weight and substance because there's vacuolation, holes where words were. And it happens. We don't feel it until it's noticed by our friends and called a senior moment. Until there are too many moments to be funny anymore. Anya knows the pathologist I'm referring to with his bow tie and his coat of many colours. He's a very eccentric character.
It's an excellent description.
Yeah. Yes, I've immortalised him as well, I suppose you could say. So, do you want to do that now? Yeah. So, before I play the next installation, Anya has very kindly agreed to read my poem about lobotomy. It's the first of a sequence of new poems and which were commissioned to go with a photographer's family photographs when he found out that his grandmother had had a lobotomy. Because obviously the question of brains in vats, consciousness, what happens when you have a lobotomy which cuts you off from part of your brain? And the lobotomy was popularized and practiced very heavily by the man whose voice Anya is going to be speaking for just now. So this was in the 50s and 60s, really, wasn't it, when frontal lobotomies, transorbital lobotomies, became all the rage in America and over here. Mm. So, Anya, if you would like to read.
The first lobotomy was performed in 1936 by a Portuguese neurosurgeon, but it then became very widely practiced in America and here. But Walter Jackson Freeman II was the neurosurgeon who did thousands per year of these operations in the States. And not because I'm that kind of neuroscientist, but because I have an American accent, Valerie thought it might be appropriate for me to read. It's her poem, Lobotomy 1, Walter Jackson Freeman II, inventor of the transorbital lobotomy in 1946. Breakthrough? A medical miracle. My method takes minutes to cure schizophrenia, splits emotion from intellect, cuts thalamocortical connections of prefrontal cortex and... But hey, forget jargon. I'm a scientist. Trust me. This is simple. My first leukotome? An ice pick from the kitchen. No need to be scared. I just drive this spike deep into the brain, skimming each eyeball, right through the socket. Hammer it home, crack the orbital bone, swing the pick like a pendulum, hammer again, give one expert wrench. Simple and safe, bam, fixed. Any place is my theater. No need for a surgeon, no messing, no fuss. No dressing, no gloves. Watch me do left and right. Both eyes at once. 25 lucky gals in one day. Yes, sir. Desperate mania, suicidal ravings. I'll wipe out any shameful cravings. Change your wife's personality. Cure stepson's sulks, mom's migraines. Communism. Electroshocks knock them out. Humane and so cheap. $200 buys a biddable wife, daughter, son. No more mania, not sleeping, no moping or weeping. Safe? I've done thousands. Rosemary Kennedy got a bit lippy, went a bit wild, worried her pa. So we put her straight. Now she lives with the nuns, guaranteed safe from scandal, an innocent soul, good as gold, a real doll. So, go on, have yours done. Sign here. So, watch me go.
Thank you, Anya. Thank you, Anya. That was fantastic. And I must say, I hope you enjoyed playing the snake oil salesman that he must have been.
Can I just put in a plug for my favorite film, which I show to my students when I teach them about the limbic system, which is the system that's severed from emotion, from reason and judgment in a frontal lobotomy, of which this is the ice pick technique. There's a fantastic depiction of the ice pick technique in the film called Francis Farmer. I don't know how many of you have seen it, starring Jessica Lange and the delectable Sam Shepard. And it has an incredibly realistic depiction of the ice pick technique being used to cure Frances Farmer of her sort of wayward behavior. Mm.
So it's quite hard to believe, but all that is true. That's all documented. Those are the kind. It started off as a cure for schizophrenia. Well, it makes people seem as if they're being cured because they don't make a noise anymore. But it was actually done to people for things like headaches and communism. Yeah. Even done to children as young as 12 for being a bit naughty. We've certainly come a long way since then, but I think it's interesting to think, you know, what would somebody who's had a lobotomy, how much of their consciousness, they may be aware that something's missing, but they can't know what it is. It's very sad. Speaking of losing consciousness, either through lobotomy or dementia. I would just like to show the next installation. Can we have the screen on, please? This installation was commissioned for an exhibition called Coming of Age, which was held in Newcastle and then in London, and it has travelled around. So I hope it plays. This one's in All That Lives, and it's also... It's on YouTube, which you can get to through my website as well. And it's very stark white on black. We found on this screen that the contrast isn't so clear, but you'll be able to hear it, so it doesn't matter if you can't read it clearly, and you will be able to see how the poem changes as dementia progresses and still remains a poem. So, let's see. If I can get this to you.
Incredible shrinking brain. Excited, she tugs me up to her bedroom, 30 years. Look, there's all this here. A sweep of her arm presents melamine wardrobes with fancy handles, the swagged pink curtains she sewed herself. Back downstairs, look, the hall, plates painted at an evening class she took to keep her brain alert, ranged on the delf rack. See, it's all gone. But look, upstairs again, a miracle. Her bedroom's reappeared like an MFI-bought brigadoon. The universe in her skull is shrinking, big crunching, and true to the predictions of physicists, her time is running backwards, rewinding what she knows and understands. Something she learned playing peep-bow with her twin in the scullery kitchen is about to vanish, but she holds it for a moment, poised between knowing and not knowing. She's amazed. Her bedroom might still exist when out of sight. Soon she will unlearn this too. But today, as her time runs backwards to a singularity, it feels to her like discovery. And today, I try to share her joy. Her bedroom of 30 years, a sweep of melamine wardrobes, the swagged pink curtain she sewed herself, the hall, plates painted to keep her brain alert, all gone. Her universe is shrinking. Her time is running backwards, rewinding what she knows and understands. Playing peep-bow with her twin in the scullery kitchen is about to vanish, but she holds it, poised between knowing and not knowing. She might still exist. Out of sight, she will unlearn. But today, her time runs backwards. Her discovery, her joy. Her years weep. A wall. She wed. He late. Her brain all gone. Her universe shrinking. Playing peep-bow with her twin in the scullery, about to vanish. She, between knowing and not knowing. She might still exist. Her time, her joy. Her years, her brain, all gone. Her universe shrinking, about to vanish. She, not knowing. She might still exist. Joy. Her brain all gone. Her universe. She not knowing. She is. Joy. Her brain all gone. Her wing. Joy. Gone.
So I designed that poem and I deliberately left joy on there because it's an article of faith with me that there is always the possibility of joy. And despite the tragedy of my mother's death from dementia, and I know many of you will have experienced this on loved ones, we still shared many moments of joy right up until very near the end. Anya, do you want to say anything about the installation or...?
Very, very moving.
Thank you. Well, I've actually lured Anya down here to pester and annoy her with a couple of questions that I have for neuroscientists. So the whole thing was just an evil trick to ruthlessly exploit her. This one is a question for neuroscientists. And I did ask this question many times. Whenever we hear about what memory's doing, it's always about it being recalled. But I want to know, where is it when it isn't being recalled? So this is a question for neuroscientists. Where does a memory sit when it's at leisure? Where does it cool its heels, await our pleasure? For whenever we are shown the busy brain, we see the thoughts and memories entertain us, but always like honeybees in a hive, entering and leaving, keeping themselves alive in restless motion, either coming in or out, or from lobe to lobe, bustling round about, in through the senses' portals in endless flow, or out through speech or action, what we know flickers from cell to cell like summer lightning, the dendrite forests darkening and brightening, as something being stored or being recalled is passed round like a parcel, never stalled, never at rest, or are there hours or days when a memory is not moving, when it stays still, drowsing like a sleepy drone, not being thought on, just being left alone. So where's its home, its niche, its nest, the place it hangs out when it needs a rest? In the nucleus at a neuron's heart, in many neurons, in what part of cell or lobe or brain does it reside while waiting for the call to come on side? And in what shape or form is it recorded until it comes forth smiling and applauded, twinkling, a galaxy of stars, each spark peppering our consciousness through dark times and good, soothing, aiding or warning, awake or in dreams, to make us smile at morning. If thought like light can be particle or wave, what is memory's photon? How is it saved? To recall them is to move them. So which cell keeps each of my honeyed memories while it sleeps? Anya, perhaps you can answer some of that.
Right. Lecture number 42. it's... the understanding of memory has advanced so much in the last decades. And a lot of it has to do with our sleeping. I think one of the most exciting research being done is on the brain as it sleeps. It turns out that when we sleep, we rehearse our daily experiences. And that rehearsal is what's essential for laying down the memories. And the mechanisms that occur while those memories are being laid down have very, this is an example of lyricism in science, lyrically been described as hippocampal ripples. So that hippocampal brain slice kept in a petri dish that showed the molecular mechanisms of memory has presaged what we've found in living brains with intact hippocampi. And what happens is the hippocampus undergoes this sharp shock, and then this ripple, this brain wave that spreads throughout it, and then enables it to have this fast, privileged interaction with the cortex, bypassing the rest of the brain. And that loop then consolidates and firms up the memory. Just as an example of scientific writing, its precision and its lyricism, hippocampal ripples, episodic high-frequency field potential oscillations, primarily occur during sleep and calmness and are associated with retention of previously acquired awake experience. The global effects of ripples on the entire brain remain elusive. And that's taken from But to answer Valerie's question, it's not just one cell. It's almost all the cells of the brain involved in almost every memory. It's a little exaggeration, but it's sort of comforting to know. So you can lose a few cells to vacuolation, plaques, and tangles, and there will still be enough who can take over and keep the cell ensemble going to retain the memory. Mm. But sleep is critical.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so as I said before about the brain compensating for the damage caused by dementia, the shrinking of the brain, it's quite amazing how long the brain can keep doing that. But of course it means that the damage is being done unseen. So that's something maybe they could learn to, yeah. Well, I've got one more poem, which is a sort of question for neuroscientists as well, particularly for eye research neuroscientists. I noticed that my mother's eyes changed when she had dementia. I could see something different in them. And I asked one of the people at Institute of Neuroscience, not Anya, and she said she didn't know, and we had a look, and apparently they have spotted some of the plaques and tangles actually in the eye, the back of the eye, some of the cells there. So that's quite strange. But what I was interested in is, do people's eyes have expression? Apart from the fact that your pupil can dilate and contract, does your eye have any other expression, or is it your actual face moving around your eyes? When we talk about eyes meeting and eyes signalling to you and what you read in someone's eyes, is it actually the body language around their eyes? I don't know. So this is pestering an eye research neuroscientist, so I pester Anya with it today. I ask, do eyes themselves have expression? Do they speak? Surely love at first sight is both the beloved's image entering our eyes and what we see come from theirs, the subtle signals of pupil and lid, language hid from conscious sight but understood. Hard though for science to explain it, hard to reproduce it in laboratories, but we know when another's eyes see us, knows us, with what emotion it dims or lights up, moistens or narrows. We can measure what goes into the eye, the effect of light which strikes it like a spear and penetrates deep to the occiput through and through. Its charge ignites the brain with colour that sears us, seems true, though the electrons of what's before us absorb the wavelengths of the colours we don't see, leaving behind the shades we do, as autumn leaves glow red and gold when green is drained away, leaving a display of redundant colour, a final show, tints which were always there now brought to bloom. But can the eye mirror the brain when the brain is failing? Can an ailing brain express itself in the eye? When the proteins clog the axons deep within, do they also clothe the cornea in a horny skin? I ask because I'd seen the eyes of my mother, afflicted with dementia, become opaque, narrow, the white stained like parchment. Was this a true observation? Was her eye expressing her clouded brain, whose plaques and tangles reached for the light? Or was I looking into them with my too partial sight? And why do our eyes spring open as breathing stops, as if avid for a last gasp of light before the dead leaf drops? There's quite a few questions in there.
There are quite a few questions, the vision and color vision is my specialty. So before attempting to extremely briefly answer any of those questions, I just have to take exception with one statement in here. Though the electrons of what's before us absorb the wavelengths of the colors we don't see, the colors aren't out there, they're all made in here. So I feel that is an example of the physical fallacy of color perception. Mm-hmm. And it's the one thing I would correct. Any of your poetry. color is an interaction of light, surface, eye, and brain. It's not a thing out there.
Yeah.
But you ask, why do eyes tell us so much about a person? And I think eyes are the windows into the soul, and that's because the brain is the soul. And, of course, the retina in the eye is part of the brain. So it is possible, actually, to look through someone's pupil and see the retina at the back of the eye, and that is part of the brain. That is the physical substrate of the self. With really contemporary, exciting imaging techniques, one can actually image the retina in a living person and see the individual photoreceptors laid out in a mosaic on the back of the eye. And a wonderful team at Oxford, Hannah Smithson, has just set up an apparatus to do this, and her graduate student spends all day just staring at her own brain in this apparatus, and she loves it. She keeps discovering new things, she says. So I do think that metaphorically the eyes are the window to the soul, but in a much more real and physical sense they are as well. And of course, the sympathetic nervous system has direct actions on the pupil. And when you look in someone's eyes and perceive great attraction, what you are really seeing is the widening of the pupil as their sympathetic nervous system goes haywire, which is why women used to put belladonna in their eyes, of course. Yeah. So there's much more prosaic explanations as well. Yes.
Yeah. But we are conscious that someone is looking at us, aren't we? You can feel. When you make eye contact, what is it that is connecting the two eyes? You know, in a different way to the way you feel about looking at any other surface.
It's very, very striking in autism, for example, in neurodevelopmental disorder. People with autism have difficulty looking directly into other individuals' eyes, and it's unnerving for them, and it's unnerving for the person speaking with them that there's a loss of personal content. Contact, and it's not clear why it might be that looking into another person's eyes arouses amygdala activation, which is a marker of fear in the person with autism. That it's too frightening looking into someone's soul. You might conclude, but it's very it's a very dramatic example of that loss of personal connection, that lack of ability to look into another person's eyes.
It could be it's too much personal connection. So they get the full impact of the other person's brain, which we don't because we filter it out through our various
could be
cultural learnings that they don't have. I think we should perhaps leave it there because we've just about run out of time. So I hope you've enjoyed, and I've certainly enjoyed hearing Anya's scientific commentary on the poems as well and experience. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.